figure in quantum gravity and quantum foundations from Imperial College. He said that he thought that the sort of proof that quantum theory is contextual, I'll tell you what that means in a moment, is the most important theorem in physics, and that it should be taught on the first day of any undergraduate course in quantum theory, or in physics, I guess. Suddenly, it shows you something about quantum theory that's different from classical physics. It kind of nails it in terms of the theorem. So the idea is we take an assumption of non-contextuality. And I'll write down the assumption in just a moment. And then we show that quantum theory is incompatible with that assumption. There's sort of two approaches that I want to cover. There's the original approach due to Kokan and Specker in 1960-something. And then there's a more recent approach due to our very own Rob Speckens. From 2005, I think. 2004. Now, this approach has certain advantages over the original approach in that it applies to sort of hidden variable models, ontological models in general, whereas this is very much tied to the quantum formalism. But first of all, I'm going to do the Kokan-Specker approach. So this is the original notion of non-contextuality. So imagine we have an experiment. I'll read the assumption first, and then I'll write it down. So we assume that in each run of the experiment at a given time, there's an underlying value. I'm going to call it VA. Which is equal to one of the eigenvalues of an operator that you might measure, or observable, A. And this is the value that would be seen if you do the actual experiment. So this is the underlying value, and it has to belong to the set of eigenvalues. For each observable, it's important that to assert that this is the value that would be seen if we actually measure the observable, because otherwise it has nothing to do with anything necessarily. And furthermore, this value is independent of any other observables we might measure at the same time. Well, since we're measuring them at the same time, they must commute. So let me just clarify this last bit of the assumption a bit. So if we measure observable A at the same time as measuring B, so then the value associated with the observable A will be the same as if we measured it at the same time as observable C. So we can just write it as a function of A. And here we need that A commutes with B and also commutes with C. Although we don't necessarily have to have that B and C commute. So what's going on here with this assumption is that an attempt is being made to think in a classical way about physics. So we're trying to say, just as in classical physics, if you have some observable, like position, then you can imagine that the position takes a value, even if you don't look and make a measurement to see what it is. And furthermore, the value that it takes is independent of anything else you might choose to measure or not, because measurements don't really disturb the system anyway. So the idea is to see if this, at least this much of classical physics, can go over to quantum theory. And of course, it doesn't. And that's what makes it interesting. Are there any questions at this stage on the idea?
Yep. Yeah, you say that this is not implied at B and C commute, but you say for any observable, so like, by saying for any observable, you already have this requirement, right? That B and C have to commute.
So B and C do not necessarily commute. So.
Yeah, but if you take the perspective of B being the observable, that you start out with, like, you have this B, B. Then
yeah, that's right. Yeah, if you were instead looking at the observables for B, and you were interested in whether you were interested in assigning a value for this, then it should be independent of anything else you measure.
Yeah.
So yeah. Sure. But I'll show you an example on this kind of thing will be clearer. So this is an attempt to think in classical terms. I'd say it's a formal attempt. So just to explain this a bit more, we can think about one type of observable that we can think of is just a projection operator. So this is the projection operator that projects onto U. It's just equal to this. It has eigenvalues equal to 0 and 1. So we require that has a value associated with it is equal to 0 or 1. If we have two such projection operators corresponding to orthonormal vectors, then they commute. If we have a whole set, whole orthonormal basis, if we have n, this is an orthonormal basis, then of course they all commute. And so we can write down that the values associated with each of these projectors in this basis, if we sum over them, we're going to get 1. Well, the reason for that is that we know that each of them individually must be equal to 0 or 1. And furthermore, we have this assertion that they are the actual values that would be seen if we measure, if we make a measurement. And we know that in a measurement, if we measure all of these quantities simultaneously, we know it's only possible for one of them to be 1, and the others have to be 0. So we know that this is true. Sorry, say that again?
Why sum over one?
Well, if we make a measurement, imagine we make a measurement of all of these quantities simultaneously, okay, then we know the values for each of them has to be equal to 0 or 1. But when you make a measurement onto an orthonormal basis, you can only get 1. Only one outcome is possible. The others have to give 0. So that's the reason they have to add up to 1. Okay. Happy birthday. I'm going to leave that there. I'll start with it. So if we have an orthonormal set of projectors pointing along three different directions in Hilbert space, well, you can consider what it means to have this non-contextuality result. What you can do is you can keep one of them fixed and rotate the other two. And rotate it so. And so because we've kept this one fixed, the value associated with this has to be the same, even though here we have two different contexts. These are two different, you know, overall, the full set of measurements that's being made is different, but in both cases we're measuring the projector along this direction. So this value has to be the same, even though we rotated in the other axis. And so this is the crucial, you can see here how the non-contextuality assumption is coming in. So what you can do now is you can look, you can search through Hilbert space and find sets of orthonormal vectors and ask if it's possible to assign values to them so that every time two sets of orthonormal vectors share an element, they take the same value. And you can show that that's not possible. And the original proof of this is due to Kokin and Specker. And they found a set of 117 vectors in a 3D Hilbert space. Kind of a remarkable feat, to, especially back in 1960, whatever it was, when computers weren't readily available, to sort of go through and find a set of vectors that big that were inconsistent. So I'm not going to write down all these 117 vectors because it would take me the rest of the week. There is a shorter proof. So Adam Cabello has a shorter proof with 18 vectors. So for a long time, people tried to find, you know, better and better proofs with fewer and fewer vectors. And my understanding is that Cabello has the world record for this. So just to establish some notation, we'll write so we're going to consider projectors in 4D Hilbert space. And to save me writing this down every time, I'll write it like this. These vectors are normalized, so typically you're going to get all sorts of square roots and so on appearing in here. I'm just going to choose a normalization constant so that these are integers to make the notation simpler. So I'm also not going to write down all of these 18 vectors. You'll find them very easily. I think they're even on the Wikipedia page.
We have them on the tutorial this afternoon.
Okay, fantastic. You'll see these this afternoon in the tutorial. But I'll write down a few of them just to give you the idea. And I'm going to write down 9, because there's 18 vectors, and they fall into 9 relationships like this. So there are four orthogonal vectors they're orthonormal if you just impose impose normalization, and you can verify that you can verify they're orthogonal if you just look at them. This one is clearly orthogonal to this one, and then these two are clearly orthogonal to each other and orthogonal to the first two. Actually, all the 18 vectors that Covello chooses are in real. You only need real coefficients. And then there's so 9 of these. In each case, they add up to 1. Now, I haven't written down all 9 of them, but if you inspect them, you'll see that each vector appears twice. So here, we have the 0, 0, 0, 1 vector appears twice. And that's true of every other vector in this list of 9 equations. So if you add up all the left-hand sides, if you add up all the equations on the left-hand sides, then, well, since each of these values appears twice, and each of them is either equal to 0 or 1, so then, because they each appear twice, they're either contributing 0 or 2. So that means you have to get an even number on this side. On the other hand, we have 9 equations. And so if you sum up the 9 ones on the left-hand side, after a little bit of mathematics, you'll find you get 9. And if you check carefully, you'll see that 9 is an odd number, not an even number. So there's a contradiction. And it proves that quantum theory is contextual. By which I mean it's not non-contextual. OK. Are there any questions on this before I move on to the Speckens approach? Yeah?
So when specifically did we invoke quantum mechanics here? Is that like just the fact that we have a Hilbert space?
Just through the Hilbert space. I mean, one problem with this approach, this Kirchner-Speckler approach, is that it's defined in terms of the elements of Hilbert space. So it's defined in terms of the elements of quantum theory. The advantage of the Speckens approach is that it's not defined in those terms. It's defined in more operational terms. So it'll be interesting once we've got the Speckens definitions down to look back at this approach and see, understand it. Are there any more?
How should I imagine the quantum theory? Like, is it that mean that before we measure some for the physical reality, like the value of the measurement is not determined? Is it the reaction?
So here we're testing the idea that before we measure, there are values there that we're just uncovering. So we're testing the idea that quantum theory is deterministic. And furthermore, that the values we see do not depend on what else we're measuring at the same time. It fails. So we know that something has to be wrong there. Exactly what's wrong depends on which interpretation you look at. So in the case of the de Broglie-Bohm model, it's still deterministic, but it violates the sort of contextual part or the non-contextual part. I'll show you that later. Any more? So you should have covered that on the first day of your undergraduate course, but never mind. Better late than never. So now the Speckens approach. Let me. So this is on the archive. Find it in that paper. And we give some definitions in terms of ontological models. So consider an ontological model. So the probability of having outcome k, given that you have preparation p and measurement m, according to an ontological model, is given by this expression. And now, before I can define what I mean by contextuality, or non-contextuality, I need to define what is meant by equivalence classes. So we say that P and P prime are in the same equivalence class.
If the P is probability P or the preparation.
So this is a preparation P, this is a big P. So these two preparations are in the same equivalence class, which we'll denote by EP, if get the same probability for P and P prime for all measurements, for all K and all M. So we may have two preparations that are different in some sense, like the boxes are different colors perhaps. Perhaps the box that prepares P is blue and the one that prepares P prime is red. But so far as their probabilistic behaviors are concerned, these two boxes have the same properties. Of course, they may also be different on the inside. They may be built in different ways, but the probabilistic behavior is the same, the two boxes, and then they belong to the same equivalence class. Any questions? Just a definition. We have a similar definition for measurements as well. In the same equivalence class, it's the same thing. get the same probabilities. For all p, okay. So now, given that, given those definitions, we now have some definitions of non-contextuality. In actual fact, Rob defines three different notions of contextuality: preparation non-contextuality, transformation non-contextuality, and measurement non-contextuality. I'll just give you the definitions for measurement and preparation, since I haven't really covered transformations in this course. So a theory is preparation non-contextual if basically if you have the same distribution of over ontic states for the two preparations. When those preparations are in the same equivalence class. So anytime you have preparations in a given equivalence class, they give rise to the same distributions. And then you can write these distributions just as a function of the equivalence class. Any questions? It's worth saying something about the motivation here. So these distributions over ontic states are not something that you can directly see. And the motivation here is that if two things are operationally equivalent, in this sense, is P and P prime operationally equivalent, then they should be ontologically equivalent. So they correspond to the same distribution over lambdas. And a sort of similar example that Speckens gives is if you think about the equivalence principle in general relativity. So then it's not possible operationally, at least for a local observable, sorry, for a local observer, it's not possible operationally to distinguish the case where you're floating in free space from where you're falling under the influence of gravity, free fall under the influence of gravity. And so those two situations are taken to be ontologically equivalent, at least locally. And that was a sort of move that was made in deriving general relativity. So the idea is that this is a similar kind of principle. Now, it turns out not to work. And so quantum theory doesn't really have this. But it's an interesting principle to explore. And you can see that these definitions have the advantage that they're not tied to the formalism of quantum theory. I didn't have to talk about Hilbert space and operators acting on Hilbert space. Any questions? So that's preparation non-contextuality. We also have measurement non-contextuality. So theory is merged non-contextual. If so for these functions that appear in the ontological model, we want that they're the same for measurements in the same equivalence class. And then you can write these functions just as a function of the equivalence class.
If I accept that equation that P probability to measure K condition of P and given P and M, like if the preparation that strong P is false, like how can P K P and is equal to P K?
How can this be true? So, here's one. So you're asking you're asking whether this already just implies preparation non-contextuality. So the important thing is that we're integrating over lambda, so we're losing information about this distribution. So here's a very simple example where you could do it. It could be that this. The distribution, if you're in P, is like this, and the distribution if you're in P prime is like this. And that these two distributions have exactly the same shape, but that when you integrate out, and likewise over here, you're kind of coarse graining, so you don't see which of these two you're in. So when you integrate out, you lose the information as to whether you were here or here, but you have all the same properties. For these kinds of things. So it's not difficult to set up models that do this.
But it has to be true for all kinds of measurement devices.
That's right, yeah. But there's a restriction on what measurement device, there's a restriction on there's a restriction on these functions coming from your theory.
That P cannot be fully general.
Yeah, this one cannot be fully general, yeah. So you're right, if it was the case that any function like this was allowed, then you could, this being in the same equivalence class would imply that that was true, but actually there's a restriction in these models there's a restriction on what probabilities associated with the measurement operators are allowed.
Like how we can refine and give a restriction on
this? If you're in the context of an actual hidden driver model like the de Broglie-Bohm model, then this thing comes naturally. But just in principle, here's another simple model. Imagine that this is a bit trivial, but still it illustrates the point. Imagine that your hidden variables consist of two pieces, mu and q. Q is equal to 0 or 1. And mu is just a distribution. Now, if q equals, if you have preparation p, you can imagine that q is set equal to 0. And if you have preparation p prime, you can imagine that q is set equal to 1. But it could be that this function doesn't depend on q at all. So that would be one way to set up this an example that does that. It's a bit trivial, but it just illustrates the point. Okay. There's another definition that Speckens gives, which I'll call outcome determinism. Or rather, he calls it outcome determinism. This is an extra thing that you could impose on these models. So you could impose that these probabilities associated with the measurement apparatuses are equal to 0 or 1. In other words, the measurement apparatus has a deterministic property that it gives you either gives you the result k or not, depending on the hidden variable lambda. That's right. Yeah. So you could. So if a particular model has this property, then you would say it also has the property of being outcome deterministic. So what's interesting is if you look at the original definition, the Koch and Specker definition of non-contextuality. I erased it, but it's really that definition assumes outcome determinism. Part of it. So you could say that the Koch and Specker non-contextuality is equivalent to having outcome determinism and also having measurement non-contextuality. And also, it's probably worth saying that this is all given we're in quantum theory. So given quantum theory, because the original definitions in the Koch and Specker case used operators and Hilbert space and so on. So one good thing about the Speckens approach is that it sort of breaks up the two different assumptions that are going in to the into these arguments, and also it puts them in the context of more general operational models, not just quantum theory. So the Speckens definitions are theory independent. At least as long as you're in the operational model framework. The second point is that they apply not just to measurements of operators or observables. So measurements of observables where you have eigenvalues and so on, that just corresponds to PV measures, which I think you would have done. Did you do projection value measures in Joe's course? Yeah. But it also applies to POVMs as well. And then also there's the fact that we separate out the different assumptions going in. So I'm not going to go through the proofs of that Speckens has in his paper. You can look at the paper I mentioned, and they're not very difficult to read through. But let me just state what is proven. So he proves that preparation non-contextuality is inconsistent with quantum theory. It proves that the conjunction of measurement non-contextuality and outcome determinism, when you have PV measures, is inconsistent with quantum theory. Essentially, that's just the Koch and Specker result translated into this framework. And then he has some more results in that paper concerning transformation, contextuality, and so on. Okay. So one question we can ask is, how natural is this assumption of non-contextuality? Should we be very worried that it turns out not to work? Backboard. Well, one model that's been well worked out is the de Broglie-Bohm model. So let's look and see. Well, we know that the de Broglie-Bohm model is a hidden variable model. It should fit within the ontological model's framework. But it successfully reproduces the predictions of quantum theory. And so we can ask the question, so we know it has to violate non-contextuality, these various things. So we can ask how it does that and see if it does that in a natural fashion or an unnatural fashion. Is it contrived? So let's just look at a very simple example. So imagine we have two paths, A and B. And we prepare an equal superposition, the state being in A and B at the same time. So we have a state just like that. These paths are very well separated, so this is effectively just a two-dimensional Hilbert space, whether the particle is here or here. So I can just write this down as that. And in the de Broglie-Bohm model, in addition to having the wave function, we also have the actual position of the particle. So the particle is actually somewhere. Let's imagine that it's in the top wave packet. So now we can perform a measurement This measurement projects onto the A1 and this one onto the B1. And if the particle is in the top, we know just from our experience with this model that the value associated with this projector is going to be equal to 1. And likewise, that the value associated with the beat detector is going to be 0. Okay. Because we know that that's the result that we would see. Now, this is just one particular way of measuring these projectors. Here's an alternative way. So we have the same preparation. We'll imagine that the ontic state is the same in the two cases, but we're going to subject it to a different measurement. So what we can do is we can bring this one down here and measure here PA. And we can bring this one up here and measure PB. Yeah, I've just let these two paths cross. So they've crossed in space. There's no beam splitter here. They're just passing through each other. And so we know that the Schrodinger evolution will just have these two wave functions passing through one another. Inside here, there'll be some crazy stuff going on, but very quickly the two wave packets will pass through one another. And so you can be sure that associated with this detector is the projection onto this path. And likewise with this one. Okay. But now we can ask, where is this particle going to be detected? Any ideas? In the De Broglie-Bohm model.
At the upper one.
Yeah. Why is that?
No crossing.
Yeah. No crossing. So. So in this case, it just goes here. But in the De Broglie-Bohm model, these trajectories can't cross. And we know that these two wave packets have equal amplitude. So an equal number of trajectories have to go to the top and bottom if you consider the full distribution. So this is going to go there. So that means that in this case, when we performed a measurement that's described abstractly by the same operators, the same projection operators, but we're going to get a different result. We're going to get, this time, we're going to get the value associated with this one is 0, and the value associated with this one is 1. So we can see that the De Broglie-Bohm model is contextual. The result you get depends on the way you perform a measurement. In fact, it is in some sense more contextual than it needs to be, because it's impossible to prove a non-contextuality result like this, where you just have projection-valued measures, PV measures on a two-dimensional Hilbert space. That's because if you want to have an interesting contextual situation, you have to vary. You need at least a three-dimensional Hilbert space to vary. If you keep this fixed, you want to vary the lower two. So the De Broglie-Bohm model is contextual, even when it doesn't need to be. On the other hand, it seems to me that it's doing this in a very natural way. There's nothing especially contrived about this. So perhaps contextuality isn't such a bad property. We just have to give up on certain classical notions. Are there any questions on this model before I? Yep.
How can the De Broglie-Bohm model explain the preparation context?
Oh, good question. I never thought about it in that context. I don't have an immediate answer to that. I'd have to think about it. Yep.
in this proof of preparation on contextuality being inconsistent with quantum theory, is there any extra assumptions like outcome determinism, or is it just that?
No, it just uses that, and it even works for POVMs. It's a sort of odd proof. I recommend you look at the paper because it's pretty straightforward and it's a bit surprising. I couldn't reproduce it right now. Any other questions? So just to finish, so in recent years there's been a tremendous amount of activity of people looking at contextuality again. It's become a very active field of research. So there's a few different notions out there of how to define contextuality, the sort of graphical notions that have been worked on by a bunch of people, Andreas Winter, Adam Cabello, others. There's the sort of notions, there's another approach being pursued by Samson Abramsky and Adam Brandenberger. And then there's these two notions here. Rob Speckens and his collaborators here at Perimeter and at IQC have shown how to push this to a point where you can really do experiments. So they derived some inequalities that follow from non-contextuality and then actually did the experiment to test them. So that was a big breakthrough because it took a long time to just on the theory side to get the concepts defined in a way that was appropriate for experiment. And then also recently there's been some work on linking a violation of non-contextuality to speed up in quantum computers. So Joseph Emerson and collaborators have been pursuing that. So it's become a very active area of research in the last couple of years. Okay.